This is St. Louis on the Air from St. Louis Public Radio. I'm Elaine Cha. The actions taken by the federal government to root out what it calls illegal immigrants are touching communities and cities across the country. The St. Louis region hasn't seen a surge of troops as in other major cities, but we are seeing ICE agents target individual businesses and their workers. That's what happened last month in St. Peter's. On September 2nd, FBI and ICE agents raided the Golden Apple Buffet. The raid also targeted two homes, detaining more than a dozen people living there. Only the restaurant's two owners have been indicted, accused of, quote, bringing in and harboring aliens. The official charges, however, tell us very little about the reasons behind this raid and how it's affecting those workers who now face deportation. To talk about this case and what it tells us about the current crackdown from the federal government, I'm joined by immigration attorney Jim Hacking. Jim, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me. I'm very glad to be here.
Jim, the Golden Apple Buffet is a popular restaurant in St. Peter's. Its owners deny wrongdoing and have pleaded not guilty, and the buffet has reopened. Now, you do not represent the owners, but workers who were detained by federal agents. Jim, what do we know about how this raid was conducted?
My understanding is that people in St. Charles noticed individuals living in these houses, and there seemed to be a lot of people living in the houses. They were leaving early in the morning, coming back late at night. There was four, five, six, seven people living in one house. My understanding is that there were actually four houses. They only raided two. And that as part of these individuals working at the restaurants, they also received a room to stay in one of the houses. And so after calls from local neighbors to law enforcement, that got conveyed to federal officials. And then they got a warrant and conducted the raids on the houses and the restaurant all at the same time on the morning of September 2nd, as you mentioned.
How is it that you became involved as an attorney?
So I have this YouTube channel where I talk about immigration, and one of the family members of someone who got detained saw me and hired our firm to represent this one person in their bond proceedings and ended up going down to the St. Genevieve Detention Center, meeting with that individual, and then the word spread that there was an attorney who would be willing to try to help these people get out on bond. They all had I ended up representing 10 of them. They all had pending asylum applications. They all had entered the United States legally, and 8 of the 10 had work authorization. So I went to work on their bond cases.
Mm-hmm. Do you know how it is they came to work at this restaurant?
So I spent a lot of time investigating that and talking to them about that, and I was worried that there had been human trafficking and that these people were victims of human trafficking. And based on my conversations with everyone, I became convinced that they had found out about a job posting online, and they moved to St. Louis to take this job and to be able to live in that house. So I tried really hard, and I tried in many different angles to talk to them to see, because a lot of times, you know, they're not even going to tell you. You have to dig a little deeper or do some research. But I found nothing from any of the 10 of them that indicated that there was actual human trafficking.
Mm-hmm. And you've mentioned that they all had entered the country legally. Where were they coming from?
So my 10 clients were all from Indonesia. They came from Indonesia to the United States. A couple were in countries in between. They all had valid visit visas to the United States. Some had been here as much as 6 years. Some had been here as little as 6 months. And they had come to the United States. And then at some point while they were here, they followed the law and they applied for asylum. They feared going back home to Indonesia from the United States, and they sought protections under federal law as asylum seekers to stay in the United States and to hopefully get their opportunity to see an asylum officer. But once they got taken into custody, they lost that chance, and the only chance they were going to have to stay was to raise asylum as a defense to deportation.
Mm-hmm. You'd mentioned Jim St. Genevieve and that you tried to get your clients released on bond after they were detained. How successful were you in that?
So When an immigrant is detained, they are entitled to see a judge. ICE can make an initial determination, and sometimes in the old days, ICE would let people out on bond. ICE isn't letting many people out on bond now. The only way you're going to get bond is from an immigration judge. So I filed 10 bond hearings in a row, 10 bond motions. The judge set them all for hearing, and brilliant lawyer that I am, I went 0 for 10. The judge ruled against us and said that each of them were a flight risk, that they didn't have significant ties to the United States. You know, sometimes you might have someone who's been here for 30 years and who's been paying taxes and working maybe without authorization, but they have a long connection to the United States. The judge let me make my record. And one interesting thing is that in criminal cases, in the Eighth Circuit where we are, a criminal defendant is entitled to bond unless the government can show that he's a flight risk or she's a danger to society. So the burden is on the government. But in immigration land, they put the burden on the immigrant and say the immigrant has to show that they're not a flight risk. And so that might seem like a small thing, but basically the government attorneys could just sit there and say, well, he lived in Texas, he lived in St. Louis, he doesn't have significant ties. That's it. And so the judge says, oh, hacking, it's your burden to show that you're eligible for bond. So we submitted evidence that there were people that wanted to take them in, people that promised to support them, people that said they would pay for bond or bail. The judge was having none of it. And we just had these 10 hearings in a row, and he denied bond every time.
Mm-hmm. Why are they being held then, Jim?
So one of the things that you have to understand about bond and about immigration detention, and it's a really big issue right now, is that making somebody stay in immigration detention is a very strong tool in their arsenal of getting people to leave the United States. These people were in the St. Genevieve Detention Center. There are a lot worse detention centers than St. Genevieve. St. Genevieve, it's a jail, and people are stacked on top of each other. It's not ideal, but it's not like Alligator, Alcatraz, and there's sometimes where people get sent all the way to Louisiana from Connecticut or whatever. And so in the scheme of things, it's not the worst place in the world. But the idea that you're going to sit in jail for months at a time waiting to see if you get deported is really a hammer to get people to throw in the towel and say, I just want to leave.
Mm-hmm. Jim, the work authorization part, walk with us through that. What does it mean to have work authorization?
So anyone in the United States, anyone at a port of entry from whatever country, if they fear going back home, if they fear they're going to be persecuted, if they go back home, they're entitled to make a claim for asylum. That's true under federal law and according to treaties that we've signed with other countries. As part of the process of applying for asylum, if you wait 6 months, you can apply for work authorization. With that work authorization, you can work for any employer that you want in any field that you want. There's people with asylum EADs, employment authorization documents, who are doing all kinds of jobs around the United States. And so of the 10 people that I represented, all 10 had pending asylum cases. All 10 were okay to stay in the United States while those cases were pending, and 8 of them had work authorization. So you apply for and pay a fee for an employment authorization document. So what I think happened was local people called the cops, said, hey, there's all these brown people living in these houses going in and out at strange times. You should raid them. They said, oh, yeah, let's go raid it. And they thought they were going to find a place where everybody was undocumented and nobody had work authorization. I think they were surprised, at least with my clients, that the majority of them did have work authorization. And then they came up with the indictment after the fact.
Mm-hmm. The Department of Justice, Jim, released a statement on the indictment, and this is for the restaurant owners. And notably, it says nothing about the workers who are your clients. So is there a crime being investigated here?
Well, to me, ultimately, it seemed like it was a housing violation. Like, let's say that we can all agree that maybe you shouldn't have 12 people living in a house, and maybe there's housing codes in St. Peter's that say you can't do that. Other than that, I think the government might have a hard time proving their case. The restaurant owners, who I've had absolutely no contact with, have very good lawyers. And I think that with the fact that my clients had work authorization, I think that undercuts the government's argument that this restaurant was just employing everybody without authorization.
Mm-hmm. The living situations of your clients is something that you have mentioned, and they're now part of the public record about this case. And according to a report by Fox 2's Chris Hayes, neighbors say that they saw as many as 20 people living in a single home. And you did note trafficking. Is that something that you thought about, you know, sort of as a matter of course, you know, in terms of just figuring out what the lay of the land is?
I don't believe that's true. I don't believe there were 20 people living in a house. And the reason I say that is because everyone that I talked to said they had their own room and their own bed. So, I mean, I'm sure that people are trafficked in much worse conditions, but my understanding is that they did all have their own space, their own particular space, and that the numbers that are being thrown around are somewhat exaggerated, because what I understand happened is they raided two of the houses, but they missed the other two, but all four houses cleared out, if that makes sense. And I don't know how far apart they were from each other.
Mm-hmm. Could the suspicion about trafficking have been why the raid was staged with a battering ram?
Oh, well, not only was there a battering ram, but two of my clients were getting out of the shower and the person knocking on the door had a gun pointed at them. So it was a lot. It was very intense situation.
Mm-hmm. Last week, Fox 2 and St. Louis Magazine reported on a secret court hearing involving these workers. And St. Louis Magazine's Ryan Krull wrote, quote, "Several of the men and women scooped up in ICE's September raid were set to be deported yesterday. However, after a secretive hearing in federal court, they will be staying in the U.S. at least a little bit longer," unquote. Tell us what was going on with this hearing, Jim.
Sure. So, as I mentioned, I had that terrible day where I lost bond hearings 10 in a row. The next day, so what that meant was that those 10 people, if they wanted to assert their asylum claims, were going to have to do so from jail, were going to have to do so in about 2 or 3 months, and they were going to have to do it in front of the Kansas City Immigration Court, which roughly denies 90 to 95% of the asylum cases presented to it. So the vast majority of my clients, 9 of the 10, said, boy, do I really want to sit in jail for 2 months for the opportunity to assert my asylum claim? Because I lost the chance to talk to the asylum officer. Now I have to talk to this immigration judge who denies somewhere between 90 and 95% of my cases. Do I really want to sit in jail for that wonderful opportunity? And they 9 of the 10 said no.
Mm-hmm.
So we filed joint motions with ICE counsel for what's called voluntary departure, which meant that they would have the opportunity to buy a plane ticket at a time selected by ICE based on ICE officer availability, because ICE officers have to fly with them from St. Louis make sure they get on the plane in St. Louis, make sure they get on the plane in Chicago or LA, however they're going back to Indonesia. So 9 of the 10 took voluntary departure. They were ready to go. I had worked with the ICE logistics people. The families had bought the tickets, and 5 of the 10 have left. So 5 have left. The defense attorneys, my understanding, what I've been told, is that the defense attorneys think that some of the Indonesian clients, because there were other people, there are Chinese people in the house and people from Mexico and Central America in the house. My understanding is that the attorneys who represent the two defendants, the owners of the restaurant, wanted testimony from the Indonesians before they left the United States. And so what that hearing was, the judge appointed a defense attorney to each Indonesian and each Mexican and each Chinese person, and they all had a big old hearing on whether these people could be compelled to testify, what they knew. I wasn't at that hearing, but that's my understanding of what happened. And so then the judge said that they should get the chance to at least talk to these people. So that hearing was closed because the majority of the people in play are asylum seekers, and asylum is secret. So asylum, it sounds very ominous that there was a secret hearing, but really it was just the fact that the judge was respecting the fact that these people had applied for asylum, and therefore the regular public and the media can't get in.
Mm-hmm. So secret, it certainly has a certain connotation. It is more about protection of those who are seeking asylum than keeping things from the public eye.
That's my honest belief, yes.
Mm-hmm. How long might these clients be detained?
Well, my understanding is that the judge is working hard to try to get these people to get their testimony. It was supposed to happen this week, but the Indonesian translator didn't show up, so those got postponed. So the judge has given the defense attorneys a short window of 7 days and now another 7 days to get this wrapped up. So hopefully for the people that have taken voluntary departure, they'll be able to leave and go back home sometime in the next couple weeks.
Mm-hmm. Are there any dependents involved here?
No.
So the last time you were on our show, Jim, we were talking about the Trump administration's revoking thousands of student visas. That was back in May. Trump eventually reversed that decision, but you had advised students at that time to be cautious. Can you provide an update on how this has affected your clients?
I sure can. So what happened in that situation was the Department of Homeland Security had the bright idea to run every international student's name through the National Crime Database. And when they did that, they had a number of hits. And then without doing any further analysis, they just unilaterally revoked all these students' visas. And in doing so, they neglected to figure out, was this person a perpetrator of a crime, a victim of a crime, or a witness of a crime? They didn't care. They just revoked everybody's visas. So myself and other attorneys filed a bunch of lawsuits in Washington, D.C. The judges were mad, and they ordered ICE to stop, and then ICE reversed themselves. And they said that there would be no adverse consequences for these students. So in answer to your question, I'm starting to hear now from international students who were subjected to that really bad treatment from the Department of Homeland Security, and they are having trouble getting their work authorizations, which they're entitled to at the end of their studies. So despite ICE's protests to the contrary, there are still significant consequences as a result of that illegal action by the Department of Homeland Security.
Mm-hmm. So has your advice then to international students changed in any way?
Well, I have lots of advice for lots of internationals, and mostly, and not just students. So you have to understand that what's happening in America right now is there's a wall, an invisible wall, that's coming tighter and tighter around immigrants. And so the $100,000 H-1B fee has a result of making people not leave the United States. The worry about not being able to get a new visa stamp makes people stay in the United States. So it's getting harder and harder for people to come into the United States. And once you're here, you leave at your own peril. You leave at significant risk of not being able to come back and live your life.
Mm-hmm. The federal government's plan for mass deportation, it has taken different shapes. And there was a focus on students, which we've just discussed. But when it comes to something like the raid on Golden Apple Buffet, is that part of a trend? You know, are you seeing a targeted focus on workers?
When you have government higher-ups declare a quota and a demand for a certain number of deportations a day, the numbers have been thrown out there, 3,000 a day, 7,000 a day, whatever it is, they, in order to keep their masters happy, they have to find immigrants to deport. Justice Kavanaugh says that you can do that based on their looks, based on their race, based on their occupation or their location at a Home Depot. They said that's anything goes. So I believe that ICE feels that they have carte blanche to do whatever they want, and they're saying, who's going to stop me? It's so absurd. We have a federal judge in Chicago who's ordering the head of Border Patrol to report to her chambers every day and to wear a body cam whenever he's doing his job. These people are off the chain. They're not following the law. They're not following the rules. They're twisting the rules. And the funny thing is, people say all the time, well, why don't these immigrants just do things the right way? Well, you know what my clients did? They went to the State Department. They paid a fee. They got a visa to come to the United States. When they got here, they applied for asylum. And after that, they applied for work authorization. And what did it get them? It got them dragged out of a shower at gunpoint, dragged into jail where they were sit to rot in the fear of definitely getting their asylum cases denied with a judge.
Mm-hmm. In our last minute, Jim, what would a win be or mean for the Indonesian client that you're representing?
So the one who decided to not take voluntary departure yet has challenged the legality of putting the burden on the immigrant to demonstrate bond eligibility. So at most, that would be him getting sent back to the immigration judge. It would be the chance to change the rules and make it so that the government has to show, like they do for a drug kingpin, that the person's a flight risk or a menace to society. That's it. He's hoping to get asylum. He has an asylum hearing set at the end of November, so we'll see what happens. But at the end of the day, that's the best he can hope for.
Mm-hmm. And in a sentence, what worries you most for your clients?
Well, I was down at the Immigration Detention Center today, and it's pretty dark. These are dark days for immigrants and for people that love them. I talk a lot on my Immigration Answers show about how the stress of all this, and, you know, I'm feeling stressed, but I'm a white guy born in Richmond Heights, so I can only imagine what people are going through, worried that they are going to get snapped up when they drop off their kids at school or when they go to the doctor or they go to the gas station. It's just really, really a dark time.
Mm-hmm. Jim Hacking is an immigration attorney in St. Louis. He's representing workers who were detained in raids last month targeting a Chinese restaurant in St. Peter's. Jim, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Lane.
This episode was produced by Danny Wissentowski.
Audio engineering and podcast design by Aaron Dorr.
Our executive producer is Alex Hoyer.
St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio. Understanding starts here.
Do you find yourself regularly listening to episodes of St. Louis on the Air? Suggest us to a friend you think might enjoy our conversations. And leave us a review and rating on Apple Podcasts on the App Store. It's the simplest way to help people discover our show. Thank you.
St. Louis Public Radio is a member-supported service of the University of Missouri-St. Louis.